speaking, your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We'll call our third case, 02-1790, Stephen Tipoim versus Janice S. Bracken. And representing Ms. Bracken is Donald Fraser. Mr. Fraser? Fraker, I'm sorry. Mr. Fraker, you may proceed.
Good afternoon. I am Donald Fraker. I represent the respondent appellant petitioner, Jan Bracken, who sits behind me and immediately to my right. If it please the court, I'd like to begin today by saying what I think this case is not about, and then move on to address some questions that I think might have been raised or left unanswered by the briefing, questions designed to test my client's position on the pending issues. One thing I think this case is not about is the myriad of ancillary motions and discovery-related requests filed by my client in connection with her effort to prevail on her motion for relief from the oral stipulation. It certainly is arguable that the methods she used to pursue her request for relief were out of the ordinary or incorrect or perhaps inappropriate, yet none of her filings, other than her motion for relief from the oral stipulation, is relevant to the question of frivolousness under 814.025 sub 3 sub b, because all such other filings had been disposed of either by letter ruling or by hearing an oral ruling without the frivolousness issue being addressed by the trial court. So by the time of the ruling awarding fees, the only filing pending was her motion for relief. And a finding of frivolousness and imposing punishment for frivolousness are not matters of assessing a party's overall conduct, except perhaps with respect to a finding under 814.025.3a that a party's sole intent was to harass. But neither the trial court nor the Court of Appeals made such a finding here. The former referred to arguments lacking in factual support, and the latter to arguments without any factual or legal basis. In contrast, under subsection 3 sub b, the only ultimate issue was whether or not Ms. Bracken's motion for relief was without basis in law or equity or underlying fact, not whether or not her other motions or filings were without such basis. The trial court couldn't bootstrap back in the motions and filings already disposed of as a consideration for its determination that Ms. Bracken's motion for relief was lacking in factual support. And therefore, Dr. Hoimy's extended arguments about the proceedings as a whole, accompanied by a litany of what Ms. Bracken had filed, and the trial court's comments about, quote, the manner in which Ms. Bracken conducted herself, end quote, were more akin to statements relating to an overtrial situation in a family law case under 767.262 than to findings of frivolousness under 814.025.3b. Plus, it really wouldn't be appropriate to look at all that a person had done, because then it might be too easy to dismiss someone who acts out of the mainstream as being unreasonable. A common sense frustration shouldn't really result in legal sanctions under 814.025.3b.
And I think what was the basis of fact or legal basis for the action taken? I mean, you're saying that you had to have a basis, right, in law or fact to the action. So what was it here?
Well, I think there was clearly a basis for her to try to get relief from the oral stipulation. She had several bases, several claims she made as bases for that. One was that she'd been confused about what was going on, so therefore there was a mistake that had occurred. Two was that after she had repudiated the stipulation, her attorney had failed to note that to the trial court, and therefore she was excusably neglectful in not mentioning that herself because she had an attorney with a duty of loyalty to her to do it. And third, the injunction that the stipulation affirmed and the order affirmed was overbroad, unconstitutionally so, because it forbid any kind of contact that she could have with Dr. Hoimy.
What kind of relief did she want?
Pardon?
What kind of relief did she want?
She wanted relief, to be relieved from that stipulation, and have a new de novo hearing on the matter, or have a de novo hearing on the matter that she didn't have before. Because the stipulation she thought was overbroad, it forbid her from having any contact. It could have forbid her from having...
What kind of contact did she want?
She didn't really want any harassing contact. She just didn't want an overbroad contact, ideally. In her mind, of course, she would have liked to have known what she was seeking all along, which was why he had broken off his relationship with her. They were engaged. I think anybody in that position would want to find out why and have some emotional need to find out why. That ideally was what she would like to have found out, but she realized...
She wanted actual contact with him then.
She would have loved to know that answer, but she knew that she couldn't continue to contact him, but she didn't want to be subject to criminal penalties if she ran into him at the grocery store or a concert.
But that wasn't what that temporary order said.
Well, the temporary order imposed by the family court commissioner said no contact whatsoever.
And that is not what that order said. That was an affirmative contact, Dr. Hoiny, and there were provisions that if they accidentally ran into each other, the last person in a public place, the last person who got there would leave. It seems to me you've got to argue not that there should have been a little bit of change in the wording some way, because I don't think that was requested. That order shouldn't have been there at all.
Well,
isn't that what she wanted, that the order shouldn't have been there at all?
I think that would have been her ideal result. Barring that, it
was that a reasonable request to make, given the facts of the case?
Well, that's a good, very good question, Your Honor. I don't know if it's harassing to ask someone, why did you break off our engagement? To get an answer to that. If she'd gotten an answer to that at the very start, I don't think any of this case would have ensued. That's all she wanted to know. They've been dating for a couple years. They were engaged. Why is it broken off? Please tell me. And if she'd found that out, that would have been it.
Maybe that's all she wanted to know, but she was, I understand it, before the court under 80607, at least sub H, that sometimes is referred to as the catch-all phrase. I'm not sure what catching all it catches, but let's see if it catches what you're interested in having it catch. And that is, you're arguing, or did argue there, that the temporary injunction was unconstitutional. It was overbroad, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And that's the legal argument you made, essentially, on the 80607 motion.
That's correct. That's the legal argument she made, actually, at that point. I was involved at the appellate level, and I made the same argument to the Court
also,
of Appeals.
Also, it's just after you're reciting the no contact. No contact is a standard, and having been a trial judge for a number of years, that's standard in this type of injunction. So is she challenging just the no contact?
She is challenging the no contact portion of the order. She wants to distinguish it from the type of cases, domestic abuse cases and child abuse cases, where the statute specifically provides for allowing no contact whatsoever. I don't think the harassment injunction statute has that same provision in it. And I think that this court in the Bukowski case had said that a harassment injunction that provides for no contact is overbroad because it can catch seemingly innocuous contacts as well as offensive and harassing ones. I can think of a number of possibilities here. Suppose Dr. Hoimy had been working at a polling place and Ms. Bracken had come in to vote. Would that have been forbidden under the circumstances?
She votes in Wales.
Yes, she lives in a different place, but she travels all around the state in connection with her work. She certainly could have run into him accidentally in some public place.
In some public place, and under the terms of the order, either a respondent or a petitioner arrive at a public place and discovers that the other is present, the last to arrive must leave immediately.
And I think that's overbroad as well, Your Honor. They conceivably could be at a convention together. Does one of them have to forfeit his deposit for the convention and go home because they're both there? I think there are all sorts of accidental contacts that are innocuous under the statute that could occur. You could conceive of a number of different scenarios where that might happen.
Well, what's before the court? Is it that this is an overbroad order? Is that the issue we have to decide? What is the issue that this court has to decide?
I think that's one of the issues, is whether or not the argument that it's overbroad is something that can be raised under 806.071H.
She may be dead wrong.
She may be.
But the issue that we have to say, is that a reasonable? I don't even know, reasonable may be too strong. But is that an argument that has a basis in law or fact, right?
I think so, yes, Your Honor.
All right. Is that the only argument? Is that the only issue we have to decide?
No, I think there's a very important issue that relates to how a litigant, what procedure a litigant must follow in order to obtain fees for a frivolous filing at the trial court level. I've made it an issue that Dr. Hoimy got fees, yet he never filed a motion for fees.
Well, when you say fees, is this under 801, the relief from the judgment, or is this fees from frivolous action?
For frivolous action under 814.025.3b. He didn't file a motion for fees. He never referred to the statute. He never even used the word frivolous in what he'd filed. It's not an onerous task to ask someone to file a motion for fees. It's a severe sanction. It's an exception to the normal American rule. And if somebody really is serious about wanting fees, I would think they would file a motion. I know it's common practice, I think maybe unfortunately, but it's common practice now that the statute is mentioned as a warning more than it's used as a weapon. Attorneys make the strategic choice to caution the other side by saying, well, we think what you're doing is frivolous. But they only file motions in rare instances if they really intend to pursue the sanctions they're seeking. So if he was serious about wanting to collect fees for what he thought was a frivolous motion for relief, why didn't he file a motion to do that? It wouldn't have been an onerous task.
Can't the court do anything on its own inherent motion?
The court can as well. The court can as well. I think that's clear from the case law, but it has to be with reasonable notice. Here the court never mentioned it. And, in fact, at the very end of the final hearing, it said, and I understand there's a motion for costs. That was the first time it came up from the court's point of view.
And what did Dr. Hoimy say?
He said, his counsel said yes, and there was a little bit more colloquy after that, and the court said, I'm awarding reasonable fees as well as costs.
Let me focus the issue. As I see it, and tell me if I'm wrong, a request for costs, didn't that appear in some brief or memorandum from opposing counsel?
Yes, after Ms. Bracken had filed her motion for relief and a number of other motions.
And so one of your arguments here today is at the trial court level, a separate motion has to be filed, and that asking for relief in a brief in support of denial or affirming a motion isn't sufficient notice, that you have to file an actual separate motion. That's what you're advancing.
Yes, I think, I think there's some case law at the appellate level that seems to say that, and I think even if it didn't, that would be the better rule, because it would be a clear-cut rule for counsel and litigants and the judiciary to follow, that if you have to file a motion requesting fees, mentioning the statute, and preferably explaining why you think fees are appropriate, and also I think it would be appropriate to file any statutes and local rules that apply to motions, how far they should be filed in advance of a hearing.
Now, are you advancing that position, that is, a motion shall be required also in an appellate, in the appellate court, if you're asking for frivolous costs as a result of a frivolous appeal?
Yes, I think the statute actually says that. 809.25 says you have to file a motion, and this is when you file it. You file it with your responsive brief.
But the statute doesn't say that with regard to 814.025.
The statute does not say it.
And so you want us to import, if you will, the language from 809 into 814
requiring a separately filed motion if an opposing party is seeking that sanction. Is that correct?
I think there should be such a requirement, and I think the three cases I cited seem to say that there is such a requirement.
Counsel, you talked to us about the injunction being overly broad, and I'm wondering, is that the only objection that you're now making to the injunction, or have you not given up on your argument under 80705 that it was based on a stipulation that was invalid under the statute?
I think that was a valid argument made to the Court of Appeals. I'm making that argument for purposes of saying that the appeal wasn't frivolous, that that was a legitimate issue raised there. I'm not making the argument separately to ask for a ruling on that issue here, other than to say that it was a legitimate argument.
I see.
Because the injunction has expired by now.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason I'm still requesting relief from the injunction is I think it would help Ms. Bracken insofar as if some prospective employer is looking at her litigation record to see that it's been vacated rather than just expired of its own terms.
Okay. Thank you.
Is that the result of this case? You should win?
Yeah.
Well, you don't have to pay money then, do you?
That's true.
That's the second result.
That's the second result, is that the fee award at the Court of Appeals level is vacated, the fee award at the trial court level is vacated, and I would hope that the injunction itself is declared void ab initio, so that that's vacated as well.
Is there a motion in this court for frivolous fees?
There was a motion filed by the respondent at the time it responded to the petition for review, and I believe this court dismissed that as being moot when it granted the petition. That's my understanding.
Okay. So as I understand it, this comes to us in a posture that you are asserting, but the court need not determine, that there were bases in law and fact for the trial court proceedings and for the appellate court proceedings. And your objection to both the trial court proceeding and the appellate court proceedings is that appropriate procedures were not followed, either statutorily or I hear a due process fair play argument.
I believe that's correct, and there's another argument, at least at the trial court level and perhaps at the Court of Appeals level too, is that 814.025 speaks of actions, cross-claims, counterclaims, defenses, and special proceedings as potentially being frivolous, and we don't have any of those here. We have a motion. Or arguments underlying a motion. And I think that's not what the statute speaks to. I think as long as you're pursuing a legitimate claim, if you, you know, say some things or go beyond the bounds in pursuing it, there are other sanctions that are available to the court. An 80205 motion for signing a pleading that's improper, or discovery sanctions, or in a family law context, at least the overtrial statute. But not an 814.0253B finding that it was without basis in law or fact, because that only applies to those specific categories.
Mr. Fraker, why is the issue in regard to the overbroadness or overbreadth, if you will, of the injunction not moot? It's my understanding that, and I think you touched on this before, that particular injunction expired the 27th of August of 2002. And why isn't the question of the applicability of 806071H also moot for the same reason?
Well, I think, as I mentioned, an overbreadth determination would void the injunction ab initio. It would clear up my client's record when it comes to prospective employers. Certainly also the case isn't moot when it comes to the other issues, the fee question issues at the trial and appellate levels. Plus, I think this court addressing the overbreadth question and the other questions is also important for future litigants and their counsel and the judiciary.
Well, when I look at the injunction, the harassment injunction, It seems to me quite specific. It talks about contacting the petitioner by phone, letter, fax, telegram, computer, in person, through a third party, or any way whatsoever, entering upon the property owned, leased, or rented by the petitioner, from which petitioner conducts his business, or at which petitioner resides, whether temporarily or more permanently, and respondent may not come into contact with petitioner in any public place. And then, as Justice Prosser was noting, if that happens, there's a device for handling the situation. What do you say specifically, other than just your statement earlier that this is overbroad because it stops contact? What specifically is wrong with that injunction? You know, if indeed what was presented to the court commissioner was a recitation of actions that would justify these particular provisions, it's my understanding under Bukowski that this would not be overbroad. So I want you to tell me, you claimed it's not moot. Tell me what specifically is wrong with this.
Well, I think the directives not to send letters or make calls or contact through other people, all those things are perfectly appropriate if that's what the underlying facts were in a case. However, I think it then went too far by saying it's forbidding any contact whatsoever and contact in a public place, which could very well be innocuous contact. It's the question of a volitional contact for purposes of further harassment. And if you're forbidding letters, you don't have further letters. If you're forbidding calls, you don't have further calls, but that doesn't stop them from accidentally running into each other in the types of places I mentioned before.
Well, am I incorrect that there was testimony presented to the court commissioner in regard to all kinds of contacts in all kinds of different ways by your client with the petitioner? Church parking lot, at his place of business, at his home, at homes involving his relatives. Wasn't that kind of testimony presented to the commissioner to justify an injunction like this?
That kind of testimony was presented, and I think it justifies the injunction to the extent the injunction speaks to those types of contacts. I don't think it justifies it to the extent the injunction goes beyond those types of contacts and forbids any sort of contact. I think
so in other words, each time there was a unintended contact, then they'd have to come back and say, no, we didn't put that in the injunction. That's what I was getting at, that it's when one looks at this, there was to be no contact, and the court commissioner was trying to abide by what he felt was reasonable. And you're trying to show us this was not. This was because you're talking about incidental contact that could take place at a voting poll, which was observed that the doctor lives in northern Wisconsin and your client lives in Wales, which I would characterize as southern Wisconsin. But you're concerned about incidental contact. But each time Justice Crooks mentioned the type of contact, that's what they were trying to avoid, any contact.
Well, certainly that incidental contact, if she sends him a letter or calls him or goes to his workplace to see him or goes to his home to see him, but it could be incidental contact in many other places, and I think it's appropriate that they would come back to the court then. I think otherwise making any contact violative would amount to the court anticipatorily abandoning its role as a decision maker in questionable enforcement cases. Because then you've got an automatic enforcement. If there's been any contact, you violated the statute and you're subject to restraints on your liberty interest. You might be thrown into jail for that. And I think that goes too far.
What's your best argument that this case has a basis in law and fact, both at the trial court and the appellate courts?
I think the argument on overbreath has a basis in law or fact. The argument on inexcusable neglect had a basis in law and fact. The argument that you need a motion for under 814025 to have frivolous fees awarded in the trial court had a basis in law or fact. In fact, I wouldn't have made any of the arguments I did if I didn't think they had a basis in law or fact. I think they were all grounded, as outlined in my brief, in cases that exist or arguable extrapolations from those cases.
There, a de novo hearing was requested.
Yes.
And that was given up because of a stipulation. I don't recall from the record that there was ever anything with respect to that stipulation that requested any changes of wording at all. And in fact, I think the court is led to believe that your client wasn't even going to show up at that hearing.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that also begs the question whether the oral stipulation was final and binding or not, and whether any threat she may have made not to show up is germane to any of the issues here, and I don't think that's the case. First of all, I think the attorneys and or the court clearly had thought the oral stipulation, that more was needed beyond that. Otherwise, they would have just done an order instead of a stipulation in order, saying perhaps, based on the oral stipulation of counsel recited on such and such a date, the court ordered that, period. And that wasn't done. It shows that more was expected, especially when the document was set up to have the parties sign it, and paragraph 2 of that proposed written stipulation shows that the document was to be used to get the parties' assent to that agreement. Otherwise, it could have been set up for just the attorneys to sign. Or you could have had the parties sign a written stipulation simply saying, we hereby recognize that an oral stipulation was put on the record as follows. Plus, the proposed order, I'm sorry, would Your Honor like me to continue?
Would you just finish quickly?
Plus, the proposed order didn't refer back to the oral stipulation, but spoke of being based on the, quote, accompanying stipulation presented by the parties. That referred to the written stipulation and said, it is hereby ordered.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Burgess.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Janice Burgess, and I represent Dr. Stephen Hoime. An early question during Mr. Fraker's argument was, what is before the court? And I think that's a critical question to keep in mind. What is before the court is an appeal of the trial court's denial of a motion for relief from a stipulated order. The question on the overbreadth or lack of overbreadth or appropriateness of the injunction has never been heard by the trial court. That's what the de novo hearing would have addressed. When that motion, when the hearing for de novo hearing on the injunction was scheduled for April 12th, that's what the parties anticipated would be addressed in front of the court. At that time, we would have pursued many of the points that Justice Crooks has raised, that the purpose of the particular injunction tailored the allegations set forth in the petition and the testimony. We were preparing to present that very case the morning of April 12th, when on the afternoon of April 11th, I received a phone call from Ms. Bracken's attorney, Mr. Auerbach, for the very first time discussing settlement of the matter. So at that time, the parties agreed to waive that Ms. Bracken's request for the de novo hearing is waived, that specifically set forth in the court's order of April 12th, that de novo hearing was waived. And we further agreed that the injunction that had been put in place would continue in place, which was an advantage to Ms. Bracken because 8 months had already run under that injunction. It was granted in August of 2000. This is already April of 2001. So it was going to continue to its conclusion rather than, in the event that an injunction was granted the next day, we would have requested an additional 2 years. So there was that advantage. Additionally, the injunction was modified so that Ms. Bracken was given one last opportunity to contact Dr. Hoime by letter. So that,
Counselor, if I understand you right, then the injunction that is we're supposed to be looking at, excuse me, is an injunction that was already in effect, the only change to it being the one contact.
Exactly.
So correct. It wasn't really based on a stipulation of parameters for the injunction, just that it would continue?
The agreement that that injunction would continue.
Thank you very
yes.
much.
Okay, then I think, in my mind, the question that my threshold question is, is a person able to raise under 806.07H a motion for relief from stipulation, and of course 806.07 specifically says relief from judgment stipulation, so that's no problem. You can get a relief from stipulation. Even if you agreed to it, you can get a relief from it. That's clear under 806.07. Do you agree?
I would agree with that under the right circumstances.
It doesn't mean you're going to win. What we're talking about is whether or not this avenue is available. I mean, I don't see that we have to sit here and revisit Baschowski, the correctness of Baschowski. We have to sit here and say, is this, can someone raise it in 806.07H? So, can someone raise in 806.07H a request for relief from a stipulation based on an assertion that the stipulation is unconstitutionally overbroad? Generically, is that 806.07H vehicle available for that type of an assertion?
Well, I think in the facts that we have before us...
My first question, I'll get to that.
All right.
Generically.
Generically, you have to make sure that you're not jumping over levels of the process, and that's why I'm trying to tie it to this case, because there never was a trial court determination of what the appropriate breadth of the injunction would be.
Let's go with the generic first.
So under
the words of the generic, under the words of the statute, 806.07, you can get a relief from a stipulation. And so that's the first part. I think that's right. And then the question is a challenge to the constitutionality, because it's overly broad, is that a kind of challenge that isn't automatically barred under 806.07?
If you can establish a reason to get around your waiver, the waiver defense to that.
Okay, so.
And I don't know what the facts would be that would establish that.
But I want to be fair, but. I think, in my mind, a good argument can be made that generically, this kind of relief, if you had the right case, I'm not saying this is the right case, but this is a vehicle for relief from stipulation in the interest of justice, the catch-all. And the catch-all can include overbreadth of a constitutional overbreadth challenge. Okay. Now the question is, can you do it in this case?
Well,
is there a basis in fact or law where such a challenge can be asserted such that it won't be frivolous?
Well, we've asserted in our brief cases which establish that when a party consents to a judgment or stipulates to a judgment and takes advantage of the benefit of that stipulation that was not available to them but for the stipulation, that they have waived the opportunity to now come in and challenge it after having taken all the meat out of it, basically.
I might be wrong, but my recollection of the facts of this case, there was a question raised. I'm not saying what the correct answer is, but I'm saying there's a question raised as to the real consent that was entered here. Am I right or wrong? I'm not saying there were, you know, it's true. I'm just saying that contested whether or not it was really consensual.
That was the basis of the hearing on March 20th. There was a great deal of testimony from Ms. Bracken and her attorney on their conversations that led them to the point where they determined that the settlement was going to be offered. Ms. Bracken's testimony indicated that she relented to the proposal to settle the case, that she had, in fact, indicated at one point to her attorney, let's just not go, let's just not show up.
So you're asserting that there's waiver, and so you don't even get the first. We can close our files because there's waiver. Okay.
The court specifically found, after hearing the testimony, that she had consented to the stipulation.
Realizing at this level that waiver is a tool of judicial administration, you know, we can get to the issue if we want to or not, whether it's waived, let's try to be brave and go down that road. So I'm going to set waiver aside. Is there any basis in fact or law for asserting that this particular injunction is constitutionally overbroad. Again, I'm not talking about whether they're right. I'm not talking about if it's a 50-50 or a 70-30. You know, I'm talking about, is there any basis in fact or law for making such an argument?
I think what the law requires you to do under Bukowski is to determine what kind of harassing behavior is involved and what kind of remedy needs to be tailored to address that harassing behavior. Given that legal background, I am very clearly supportive of our position that this was the injunction necessary to prevent that harassing behavior. We can have the esoteric conversation about the potential for the parties running into each other at a polling place. They live hundreds of miles apart. They do not cross paths during the course of a day. Dr. Hoyme lives and practices in Marinette, Wisconsin. Ms. Bracken lives and works in Wales, Wisconsin.
Let me just follow up with one additional question at this time. And Bukowski, of course, is a harassment injunction. The law is different regarding harassment injunctions as opposed to the specific statutory provisions regarding domestic abuse. And we've got the Bukowski case in there, and I don't have the words right in front of me, but essentially it was no contact. You can't have any contact, period. Am I right or wrong? And was it that broad?
It was that broad.
It was a very broad. I'm looking for the exact words, and they're not right in front of me. But it was very broad. And the court said, you can't have it that broad in a harassment as opposed to domestic abuse injunctions. And it's a brief discussion, but it indicates that you need specific acts, that you can't have any contact, any, quote, the judge's order enjoins, here it is, Solomon from, quote, harassing Bukowski or having, quote, any contact with him. This language, unfortunately, could prescribe constitutionally protected language. So they said, you got to be specific. You got to say, just like you said, what's the harassment that's going on here? And then you need a specific prohibition, a specific injunction with regard to that. So with that, by way of background, and I'm pushing you, isn't it arguable here that the language that ends up saying or any contact whatsoever is a bit overbroad?
In this circumstance, no, because I am of the belief, and I believe the court commissioner came to that same conclusion. Ms. Bracken is a very bright woman, and she is very, I'm grasping for the word, but she's able to find ways around when something blocks her. When she couldn't have direct contact with Dr. Hoyme, she contacted his mother, she contacted his brother, she contacted his ex-wife. She sent letters. She encountered him in his church parking lot and held on to the door handle of his car so he couldn't drive away. And again, this is not her parish. This is not her congregation. She has sent him letters about attending conventions, medical conventions, circling dates. This is all in the record in the petition. There was a lot of effort on Dr. Hoyme's part initially, then Dr. Hoyme and his attorney following that up to try to persuade Ms. Bracken to simply move on with her life and go in whatever direction she wanted to go and leave Dr. Hoyme out of her life.
The reason for specificity in part is because it can form the basis of a criminal charge, according to the language of the case, and that therefore you want specificity if you're going to have the basis to serve as the basis for charging criminal conduct. Is that correct, Ben?
I would submit to that, yes, Your Honor.
Counselor, my concerns are in a little bit different direction than my colleagues. I'm concerned about the procedural problems in the trial court. And when I say procedural problems, I mean the lack, at least the alleged lack of notice that there was going to be any kind of a hearing on whether her actions were frivolous, the lack of a motion by you that was pending and then heard, the lack of some kind of notice by the trial court if it was doing it sua sponte. Can you address that, please?
I would love to, Your Honor. First of all, in our very first brief in response to the series of actions, the motions that began in August and continued through the following March, in Ms. Bracken's attempt to get relief from the stipulated order, we indicated that this was continuing to harass Dr. Hoyme, that these matters were baseless in law or fact, and the direct language is quoted in my brief, and that we were specifically requesting that Ms. Bracken be ordered to pay Dr. Hoime's attorney's fees in responding to all of these matters. We did not use the magic word frivolous. However, in the cases that my brother counsel has cited to the court in his reply brief, that doesn't work either, because one of the parties used the magic word frivolous, but nothing more. And the court said, well, that isn't sufficient notice. You just said this is a borderline frivolous argument. It wasn't clear that you were looking for sanctions. We very clearly said, we're looking for attorney's fees. This is baseless. This continues to harass my client, which is one of the bases under
814.025, but I thought they made it no reasonable basis in law or fact. I didn't think there was a determination under the provision that talks about harassment. Am I wrong on that?
Well, what it says, Your Honor, is that a frivolous action is an action that was commenced.
I know what the statute says. My concern is the provision that the trial court used, and I thought the trial court used the no reasonable basis in law or fact.
I'd have to look at his order to tell you that.
All right.
Well, tell me, talking about procedure. So you're at the very end, I gather, of the hearing. And the trial court indicates that it's ready to talk about frivolous actions and fees and costs, right? So what proof do you have to put in?
What happened, Your Honor, was very abrupt.
It
was very abrupt.
Okay.
The point I was making earlier, the notice was there that we were looking for them. Obviously had
by motion. It was in a trial court brief.
It was in our brief. There was not a separate motion.
Was the brief labeled motion? Was the brief labeled?
No, the brief was in response to the entire series of motions that Ms. Bracken had filed.
Right. Did you use the word motion in the brief?
I did not use that word. I will tell you my intent. My intent after the hearing was to file it before a judgment was entered, because that's the timeline under the statute.
For the trial court?
In the trial court.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't.
Did you ever do that?
The court granted it. He raised the matter himself. He got a little bit ahead of me.
Raised it, was abrupt and heavy, said what to you?
Is there a motion for costs? After he ruled on the hearing and specifically addressing not only the testimony that he found, but the specific facts that Ms. Bracken sent to her attorney the morning of the stipulation, saying we left it that I wasn't going to show up. Why'd you call him and tell him? We intended to, this way it would cost them more money. In response to that, the court didn't ask, is there a motion for costs? I indicated, yes, Your Honor, we did ask for costs. I would like an opportunity to tax those costs and present them. And he said, based upon the manner in which Ms. Bracken has handled this matter here today, I'm granting attorney's fees. So
he mentioned the frivolous statute?
No. The statute itself was not cited.
Did you cite the statute?
You
didn't cite the statute during the hearing. Did you cite the statute in your brief?
Brief? No.
Okay.
No, we didn't cite the statute. We described what it is, the type of relief that we were looking for.
Did you cite that it was frivolous and on what basis in your brief?
Harassing, running up his attorney's fees. We went through the continuing harassment of Dr. Hoime by perpetuating this. I believe I referred to it as litigation by harassment.
Okay. So what does he say Ms. Bracken, what does she have to say or what does her lawyer have to say about the issue?
Following the court's ruling, I then prepared an order.
Before the judge announces that he's assessing fees and costs, does he give anyone an opportunity to talk?
It was not very lengthy, Your Honor.
So then what did you do?
Then I forwarded a draft order along with that attaching the attorney's fees that we sought to assess.
Okay.
And that was submitted under the 7-day rule, and it was provided to Ms. Bracken. She then filed written objections to the order, objecting to the finding of frivolousness, objecting to the attorney's fees.
So now you're put in a statute number? And is it in the appendix here?
It's referenced. I'm not sure if the pleading itself is in the appendix.
All right.
But she did address it in her objections. The court then entered the order, awarded the attorney's fees.
Entered the order you drafted in the form you drafted?
In the form that I drafted it.
Still no hearing of the parties?
No argument before the court.
No argument, okay.
No oral argument. There was written argument submitted. Ms. Bracken then submitted a motion for relief from that order, one or two more pleadings that are spelled out in my counterstatement of the case, which were later denied by the court.
And is it your position that that gives adequate notice and an opportunity to be heard? I mean, what you're doing here, it was about $7,000 at least at that time, right?
$7,000 in the trial court,
so
yes.
You're imposing on a party, and there's jurisdiction because she's before the court. She came there, so she's before the court. You're imposing $7,000 without notice, without an opportunity to be heard, and with findings that you drafted, but that the trial court never expressed.
Well, I would disagree with the court that it was without notice. I would submit that from the very beginning, our request for attorney's fees
even though no statute was mentioned.
Without a specific statute being cited.
Uh-huh. Okay, what about the opportunity to be heard?
There was no oral argument on the case, but Ms. Bracken did have an opportunity and took availed herself of it to submit written objections.
Only after the judge entered an order.
He hadn't entered the order.
After the judge made the decision.
He indicated that he was awarding attorney's fees, but he had not entered an order at that time.
You think that's what this court ought to say is a good procedure, a proper procedure under the statute?
Under that statute, Your Honor, there is no requirement for a hearing, and in fact, we've cited to you case law in our brief that says if there is sufficient basis in the record, the court, without a motion, can decide on its own that that the matter has been frivolous, and only if the record before the court at that time is insufficient to make that finding should the court schedule a hearing, which is why we went to great length to explain to you, and I disagree with my brother counsel, that everything that was before the court from the filing of the motion in August of 2001 should be considered because that's the overlying action.
Did the judge say that there was a sufficient basis in the record and spell it out?
I don't believe that. What he said is the way that Ms. Bracken has conducted herself here. He was responding directly to her own statements that she had agreed to the stipulation, although later on she didn't want to do it, that she had received a copy of the stipulation, didn't sign it, had talked to other attorneys who advised her to call the court, but she chose not to call the court to ask him not to sign the stipulation. All of this before the stipulation was signed by the court. And
Counsel, I'm going to look at the statute. We're dealing with now in our discussion the trial court statute on frivolous claims, not the Court of Appeals. So let's go to that statute. That was the line of questioning, and that's 814.025. Now, the language of 814.025 is in part verbatim to the language of 809 dealing with frivolous appeals.
Correct.
And you need two things, either or. You need, and I'm looking now at 814.025, you need either that the action, special proceeding, et cetera, was used or continued in bad faith solely for the purpose of harassing or maliciously injuring another. And was there any... I take it that your brief, since you didn't cite any statute, you didn't track that language and make that kind of assertion that would come under that language. Did you make the assertion that would come under the sub B language, that is, that the party or the party's attorney knew or should have known that there was no basis in fact or law to continue this matter? Which one of, I know you didn't cite to anyone, but which one do you think you were going under, since this is the statute apparently that costs were awarded under? Then I'm going to ask you, which one do you think the trial court went under?
Well, actually, although I didn't cite the statute, I specifically used the word harassment.
Okay. Now, that harassment, the problem with sub A under 814 is, of course, the cases Global Steel Products and one just recently that came out, Wisconsin Chiropractors, there has to be a specific finding, as I understand the law, that the harassment is solely for the purpose. I mean, that the conduct, rather, is solely for the purpose of harassing. And if the conduct is for other reasons, then you can't get it. That's what I understand to be the law. I might be wrong in my interpretation of Wisconsin Chiropractors and Global Steel, but that's my interpretation. So is that what you asserted, that not just harassing, but was there some kind of a finding, if you're going under sub A, that it was solely for the purpose of harassing?
I believe the reliance upon the affidavit that was entered into evidence at the hearing from Ms. Bracken, where she basically castigated Mr. Auerbach for contacting me the night before to let me know that it was going to be settled, that her agreement was they were going to leave it, that we would not show up, that would cost them more money, something to that effect. My argument in my brief was that this, and I may have used the word solely, I can't find the language, that this is intending to harass.
Now, what did the trial judge, was his finding on costs, was it A or B? Because there's different requirements if you do it under A as opposed to B. What was his finding with regard to why he would impose $7,000 worth of costs, under which one?
He didn't address either A or B, but the basis for his finding was, number one, the agreement that, or the, his finding that she had consented to the stipulation, which I believe would support an inference that he found no basis in law or fact to try to set aside the order, claiming mistake when actually she had consented to it, and harassment again because of the affidavit for allowing us all to show up, incur costs.
Mm-hmm. Probably, I don't know this, but probably no determination that it was solely for the basis of harassment, or do you, I don't know.
He did not make that specific word finding.
So you think maybe his, if he didn't make a specific finding that it was solely for the basis, that may or may not be an impediment, but your argument is certainly B is there, that he indicated there was no basis in fact or law.
Well, in its opinion, the Court of Appeals stated that the trial court could infer, they could infer from that affidavit that her purpose to run up the attorney's
fees. And indeed, the Court of Appeals, when you look at 809.25, again, you have the companion language under sub 3, frivolous appeals, and then you go out of C, 1 and 2. And 2 is the same wording as B under 814.025 sub 3, and the Court of Appeals did go under 2, which is no basis in law or fact. The Court of Appeals did not go under 1 solely for the purpose of harassment. Is that right? So that's what we're here on, apparently, at least in terms of the Court of Appeals, not solely for the purpose of harassing, not sub A or 1, but just a determination of frivolousness based on B or 2. Am I right or wrong?
In the Court of Appeals, Grant?
In the Court of Appeals, it was definitely 2.
Right.
I don't have any doubt about that. I'm still not totally sure what it was in the trial court.
Well, and I believe that the Court of Appeals recognized that it could be either because of its statement in the trial court, that the trial court could infer from the facts that she was intending to harass by running up his attorney's fees in bringing the action.
Solely for the purpose of harassment.
If B wasn't enough, I believe that they would find either A or B in the trial court.
Well, did everybody get an opportunity at the Court of Appeals to be heard regarding the frivolous appeal determination?
Yes, there was a motion filed.
And was there a hearing?
In accordance. That hearing was scheduled, but then this appeal was taken, and so that hearing is stayed until this decision has been resolved. The Court of Appeals granted frivolous action, sanctions, and ordered, remanded the case to the trial court for a hearing. But that hearing is now pending.
What was that hearing going to determine?
The amount of attorney's fees to be awarded.
Well, I'm asking whether the Court of Appeals had a hearing on whether the appeal was frivolous.
It did not have an oral argument. Both parties addressed that in their briefs. Briefing was filed in accordance with the 809 court rule.
All right. And you think that the Court of Appeals made specific findings to support conclusion?
I believe that it did, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals went paragraph by paragraph through all of the allegations asserted on appeal and indicated why they were not borne out by the record, not supported by case law, no arguments to for a good faith extension of the case law. I believe that the Court of Appeals' opinion clearly supports a determination that there was no basis in law or fact.
I think that's the way it should be done.
I believe that that's a fair and adequate way for it to be done.
Then in the Court of Appeals, indeed, a separate motion was filed for frivolousness. Is that correct?
Yes, a separate motion. And in fact, Your Honor, there was no request for oral argument in the Court of Appeals by the petitioner, although I did indicate that if they wanted to see us, I'd be happy to come down. But that was not scheduled.
So if you had the opportunity to write this opinion, how would you write it? Remember, we're not only deciding your case, but we're deciding basic issues that deal with frivolous. Right? Trial court frivolousness here.
Dealing with frivolousness, I would write that because of the distinction between the way that cases come before a court in the trial court as opposed to the Court of Appeals, that explains part of the distinction between the statutory requirement, that it is not necessary for there to be a motion if the facts in the case provide adequate notice to the parties, and if the record on, as the case law presently stands, if the record itself is clear. Now, my personal preference would have been to have the motion. It was my intention to file it once the court had ruled. However, he was a little bit ahead of me on this matter and took it up at that time, although it was not, I mean, he brought it up as a question. Is there a motion pending? And the matter was filed, not in a specific form of motion, but in the trial courts, the strict form of the pleadings is not necessarily applied when the clear notice, which is what the cases have relied upon, appear. So I would argue that if you have a case where there is adequate notice and a sufficient record to determine frivolousness, because in this case, I don't think the clear frivolousness was apparent until the end of the hearing. I did not know that the affidavit that became the key to this decision was even out there until it was provided to me by Mr. Auerbach in cross-examination on the witness stand. And until the judge had the opportunity to hear the testimony of Mr. Auerbach and Ms. Bracken, he did not know whether there had been a consent to the underlying stipulation or whether there was the mistake or confusion upon which she was seeking to have it set aside, which is why he set the hearing in the first place. At the appellate level, it's different. Because the proceedings travel at a slower pace, the record's there. Everybody knows what's going to come in and what isn't going to come in. The only thing left to determine are the arguments and the research to find the case law. But that, I think, justifies the distinction between requiring a motion in advance, allowing the party's argument, if requested, to address that issue, and proceeding in the fashion that the Court of Appeals did here by explaining its decision on every point raised in the appeal as to why, at the conclusion of its rationale, it determined that the appeal itself was frivolous. And in my brief, I have referred to the question of frivolousness per se, and I'll just leave that as it is in the briefs.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me clarify in answer to what Justice Bradley asked my fellow counsel. The trial court, in its determination of frivolousness, didn't refer to either part of the statute. It didn't even use the word frivolous. That word first appeared in the order drafted subsequent to the hearing. And the order refers only to no basis in fact. So I think it's clearly under the 3B part of the statute and not under the 3A part of the statute. I think it's important for notice purposes to note that Section 814025 serves a dual purpose, not just to punish offenders, but to deter offenses. And I think the deterrent effect would be maximally realized by requiring a motion to warn offenders or alleged offenders of exactly what they're facing. And conversely, if any type of notice were to be deemed sufficient for frivolous fee relief, that would tend to encourage every litigant to make a cursory allegation of frivolousness as a matter of course, as a means of preserving the opportunity to argue for fees if the case should turn out badly for the opponent. I think a request for fees should be the exception, not the rule. And requiring a motion certainly would be consistent with the statutes and the local rules that require formal motions to be filed so many days in advance of a hearing. Why should there be an undue relaxation of motion practice in this particular area? Here, moreover, the allegations of baselessness referred to a series of motions and to legal proceedings. They didn't specifically refer to the motion for relief, so it wasn't even specific to the conduct complained of. I think the so-called notice has to be considered too imprecise, even if no motion or mention of the statute or reference to frivolousness would be required under 814.025. In addition, I think that requiring a formal motion for fees referring to the statute would be less onerous than the practice in federal court, where under Rule 11, a party feeling put upon must call the other side to discuss and attempt to conciliate on the issue before even filing a motion for fees. And again, there's nothing onerous about having to file such a motion. It's a rather simple process. Attorneys do it all the time. And I think filing it after the courts have made its ruling is too late. It's the horse is already out of the barn at that point. There's nothing submitted also by Dr. Hoimi to controvert the cases that we cited to say that an 814.025 motion is needed prior to a determination under the statute. As far as what the Court of Appeals did with regard to whether the appeal was frivolous, I think what they did was too cursory. They ruled against the assignments of error raised, but they didn't really address why they thought each one of those was something that shouldn't, an argument that shouldn't have been made in the first place. I think they have to go beyond saying just reciting the words of the statute or part of the words of the statute and be done with it. I think it's important for litigants to know precisely why they're being called to task. I think the court should, court's analysis should include a discussion of why each particular claim of error runs counter to established law and or equity and is so far-fetched or logically untenable that the request for changing the law must be considered to have been made in bad faith. I think it should include a discussion of why the law couldn't conceivably be extended or construed so as to apply to the situation in the way contended for by the appellant. In other words, was the question honestly debatable or was it completely indefensible?
What relief are you requesting?
We're requesting that the Court of Appeals determination under 809.25 that the appeal was frivolous be reversed. We're requesting
you don't want a hearing on that?
I think it should be reversed outright because they didn't explain their ruling, and this court is certainly the final arbiter of what's reasonable or not reasonable and what the law should be as to what the courts of appeal should address as to whether something's frivolous or not. I think that issue could be decided here rather than remanding it for any purpose to the Court of Appeals. We're also requesting relief from the determination of frivolousness at the trial court level for several reasons, including the lack of a proper fee motion. Would you like me to continue, Your Honor?
Please do.
Lack of a proper fee motion and the fact that what was claimed to be frivolous was a motion for relief, not an action or a defense or any of the other categories that the statute refers to.
I've been looking at the Court of Appeals decision, and they go through each of your substantive arguments, and they hold against you. They then get down to paragraph 18 and 17. They say that it was in the brief, and therefore Hoyme gave Bracken adequate notice. That's it. The Court of Appeals then says that the trial court never made a finding or findings to support its decision, and then it said it expressly determined that Bracken's testimony was not credible and that she authorized her attorney. So they're into the substance there. Court noticed that the evidence showed Bracken had intended not to show up until her attorney appointed the wisdom of it, etc. Court's opinion demonstrates that it found no factual or legal basis for Bracken's motions and that she should have known none existed. We conclude the trial court's finding adequately support the award of fees. That's what the Court of Appeals says about the trial court, right?
Right.
This is what they say about the appeal. It's three sentences. We further conclude that Bracken's appeal is frivolous and without any factual or legal basis. Hoyme is entitled to attorney fees on appeal pursuant to 809.25. We remand for assessment of costs. They don't explain why the appeal is frivolous.
No.
You lost it, but not every loss is frivolous.
Correct. Absolutely.
That's your problem.
Not every loss is frivolous. They didn't say, for instance, why they thought it was unreasonable to argue that a motion for fees should be required at the trial court level prior to an award of fees at that level. They didn't say that's an unreasonable position to have taken on appeal.
So
just to cite one example.
Even if you just appealed on the frivolousness in the trial court, you'd think there was a basis of law and fact on that.
I do, absolutely.
How many bases of law and fact do we need for you to win? One
on any issue, I believe. But I believe I had bases in law and fact for all the assignments of error that I raised at the Court of Appeals level.
Counsel, I have one last thought for you. If we would agree with you and conclude the matter should be reversed, can we send it back to the trial court for the hearing it never had on whether her motion was frivolous?
Again, I think it's too late at that point. The judge has already made a ruling that it was frivolous. I think, to say what I said before, the barn doors shut behind the horse at that point. It's too late. There wasn't the notice that was required. There wasn't an opportunity to have a deterrent effect for her to say, oh, wait a minute, I better be careful. There's this motion now filed under 814.025. I better reconsider carefully whether I should go forward with my motion for relief on these grounds or not. She didn't have that opportunity, and now it's too late to have that opportunity.
Thank you.
Well, you can very well, at least lose a big battle in this war if the court does not give you relief from the harassment injunction. I mean, the court could say that and yet at the same time give you relief from the frivolous or give you relief from the harassment injunction and not give you relief from frivolous. Well, that's a little harder. You agree?
Yes, there's any combinations of decisions that could be made, and we're asking for relief from all of them.
Counsel?
Thank you,
thank
Your
Honor. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Fergus. Thank you, Ms. Fraker, for appearing today and discussing frivolous with us, an issue that's come up a number of times in the past. That closes the hearing on 02-1790, Stephen H. Hoyme versus Janice S. Bracken. And we are in recess until Friday at 9:45 when we have oral arguments again.